This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. As a teenager in Pittsburgh, one of my favorite trips was to the Carnegie Museum of Art. It was my home for massive Monets and shocking hometown Warhols. It was also the place I first encountered Saul LeWitt. It was a wall, of course, the wall that led up a grand modern staircase connecting the museum's contemporary wing with its more traditional building. Large blocks of colorful paint animated this atrium, and it caused me to walk slowly up the stairs every time. But it was years before I realized that this was anything more than a new paint job put on by the museum. It was living art, not painted by the artist himself, but by assistants. It made me think at the time, what about art really makes art? If Saul LeWitt didn't put the brush on the wall himself, was it his piece of art? Today, Where We Live, we'll look at this and many other questions raised by Saul LeWitt, a Hartford-born artist who made his mark around the world but made his home here. You can see his art on display at many museums in our region, and we'll be talking about them today. We want you to join the conversation. Call us at 860-275-7266. Have you been moved by Saul LeWitt's art? Did you know the man? We'll start first with a new exhibit called An Exchange with Saul LeWitt. It's an exhibit that's taking place with both Mass MoCA in North Adams, Massachusetts, and Cabinet Magazine. You can find their headquarters in Brooklyn. It's inspired by Saul LeWitt's exchanges of artwork with various artists throughout his lifetime. It's furnished by over 1,000 artists who answered an open submission for images, objects, music, film, books, and ephemera inspired by LeWitt and his artist's code of conduct. Regine Basha joins us. She's the curator of An Exchange with Saul LeWitt. She's on the phone with us today. Regine, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, maybe you can explain the idea behind this exhibit.
Sure. Well, this was actually inspired by a visit to Saul LeWitt's own private collection in Chester, Connecticut, which houses so many personal items from exchanges that he's had with artists over the years since the 60s, really. So a lot of really famous artists are in there, and it's a very impressive collection. But what really struck me as unique was there was all this art that had come into him from people who did not know him. People sent their work to him just as a sort of show of love or an admiration. And the curator informed me, Janet Pissell, who works there, informed me that Saul always sent them a work back. And I found that to be extremely unusual for an artist to do that if they didn't know who the person was. So it led me to start thinking about how Saul LeWitt considered his exchanges, not just only as a generous act, of course, but also perhaps it was part of his work. Perhaps it was an instruction, and I say code of conduct because, in a sense, he honored any kind of art making. He honored that as a form of communication, and I was really struck by this idea and started to, you know, think about continuing the exchange even beyond his life, and just to see what would people send in if they had a chance to exchange a work with Saul LeWitt.
So what are people sending in? What does this exchange look like right now?
Well, remarkably, it looks somewhat close to the private collection aesthetically, in that the spectrum is really from what I call high concept to personal memento, or even voodoo, if you will. There are a lot of items that are inspired by the work. There's families of work that look like repetitive line, obsessive repetitive line making. There are a lot of cubes. There are a lot of, really handcrafted, labor-intensive work. There's work that's related to his early work, like his Sentences on Conceptual Art, which was sort of like a manifesto. A number of contemporary artists took that on and dialogued with that, whether in sound or had written a text for it. And then there's this sort of memento mori, there's interesting little objects that people had sent. Someone actually sent a wisdom tooth. someone sent a stuffed monkey. I mean, the surprises kept coming. I did not know what to expect. Wine, recipes, things that either related to his work or related to his person, his, personality. Some people did know him, and they sent anecdotes of, how they met him and so on. So we did get a sense that there was a personal take as well, which was really lovely.
We're talking with Regine Basha. She's the curator of An Exchange with Saul LeWitt. It's an exhibit that's going on with Mass MoCA and Cabinet Magazine. It's inspired by his exchanges of artwork with various artists that he knew and appreciated over the years. This is Where We Live. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Today, we are celebrating the life and the art of Saul LeWitt. In just a moment, we'll be talking with someone who can give us a big perspective on this art. But I want to right now bring in Hope Sandro. She's one of the artists who's taking part in an exchange. Hope joins us by phone from Long Island. Welcome to Where We Live.
Oh, I'm so happy to be speaking with you.
So maybe
be part of this exhibition and installation.
Well, maybe you can explain what exactly it is that you've contributed to an exchange.
It actually was a very momentous time to go to the opening of Dia Beacon and see his work installed in such a large scale amongst his colleagues. And everyone that goes there is really taken by the experience. And while I was focused on that, my attention was drawn to a tiny movement on one aspect of the drawing. And when I went up close, I realized it was a spider. And that was a transforming time in my own thinking about my work, because when we think of conceptual art, we think it's very removed from daily life and from nature. In fact, I found it fascinating that the spider would feel at home in one of his drawings. And therefore, this last year, when I was considering what type of coops to build for these chickens, one of which the story is, and it's actually true, the reason I have chickens is that one followed me home, and as an artist, it's really important to follow a certain path of what comes before you. When I recalled the spider, and I thought, well, if the spider was happy in one of his designs, I think maybe my chickens would, and so there was an exhibition of his work at Pace Wildenstein in the city, and I saw a parallelogram drawing there. And then we took that and transformed it into three dimensions and another one of his drawings. And so we constructed two coops that are his work realized in three dimensions, and our flock lives in them happily.
And they happily live in these chicken coops, LeWitt. When you saw this spider first on the wall drawings at Dia Beacon, perhaps you can explain a little bit, Hope, what these wall drawings are. Many in our listening audience have probably been to Dia Beacon. Many others have not. Explain the intricate wall drawings that are on display there that this spider was having a little dialogue with.
They're very large rooms, and the ceilings must be 20 or 30 feet high, and maybe each wall is that dimension as well. And the entire room is inscribed with his drawings, which are very mathematical, and they have different shades of colors, but it's all very subtle. In fact, I was there recently, and there's one room of his drawings where you have to really look carefully to even pick up the thin lines that are on the walls. And so it's easy not to see them in a certain way. And maybe that's what the spider liked about them.
Well, Hope Sandro, thank you so much for joining us for a few minutes. And I assume that the chickens will be living in these coops that you've built for a little while. Are they going to be happily laying eggs and whatnot?
Oh, they've been living in them over a year. And basically, they free range. And it's their choice if they want to be in them or not. And that's why I say they live in them happily, because they can sleep in trees. They don't need to be in those coops, but they actually choose to be in them. And we carefully chose materials that resembled how his drawings were painted. So there's a lot of light that comes in. We really honored the whole spirit of his drawings and how they are part of life, and that one doesn't need to approach conceptual art as something that doesn't apply to oneself.
Well, thank you so much again, Hope Sandro, for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your interest. And the chickens would love to have spoken too, because they really love the coops. But it was raining today, so I couldn't be out there with them.
Well, it's raining on Long Island, and it's snowing and sleeting here. Regine Basha, maybe you can give us a sense of whether or not Hope Sandro's exhibit as part of this is typical of some of the submissions that you're getting.
Well, Hope's was wonderfully, one of the submissions that had a life already, and I was so happy to know that she already had a dialogue with Saul LeWitt. And Yes, she is certainly one of the few, I think, and you know, I singled her out here because it has a life beyond, you know, the work, and it has this function, and you really get the sense that Solowit, with his famous humor, would have really loved this piece.
Now, we're talking about the work of Saul LeWitt. As I said, many in our listening audience do know his work, his large-scale wall drawings and paintings. Others don't. And so hopefully we're going to give a sense of what this work is like and the scope of it. One of the things that Hope Sandro said while she was talking with us is this idea of conceptual art. And here's Saul LeWitt in his own words talking about what he thinks conceptual art really means.
I wanted to reject minimalism, and I wanted to do something that was involved what I thought would better be described as conceptual. Although the term was already in circulation, it came through the Fluxus group were using the term, but they really were direct descendants of Duchamp and Dada, which was something that I really wanted to avoid. And there's the confluence of the two terms, but their ideas were totally different. And both ideas were conceptual, but conceptual in different directions.
To explain these ideas of conceptual art and minimal art that Saul LeWitt embodied and embraced, Robert Storr, the dean of the Yale University School of Art, he was curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture at the Museum of Modern Art in New York from 1990 to 2002, and he's recently worked on a film called Saul LeWitt Wall Drawings. It's a film that will be screened at the Wadsworth Athenaeum on March 17th. We'll have more information coming up on our website, WNPR.org, keyword where, a bit later on. Robert Storr, welcome to Where We Live.
Well, it's nice to be here.
You heard Saul LeWitt in his own words talking about conceptual art. When you hear him described as a conceptual artist, is that about right, or is it a more complicated description than that?
Well, I think it is definitely right, and he, in fact, chose that to write both the sentences on conceptual art, which is a long sort of explanation of his ideas, and also paragraphs on conceptual art, which elaborate those ideas. For the general public, the word conceptual may be a little bit daunting. I mean, it may suggest something terribly cerebral, terribly remote, terribly esoteric. And what's wonderful about Saul's work and about his way of thinking about things was that it's the opposite. He was very, very direct in what he said. He was very concerned that ideas take form in ways that are, if you will, rigorous and clear, even though, as he said in the first of his sentences on conceptual art, the premise for it is a kind of leap of faith, a kind of mystical intuition of what one should do. But after that, the method is very, very strict.
Because we're talking to a broad audience, as I said, many of whom know his art and many of whom don't, describe it for me in your own words, Robert Storr. What might people experience if they saw Saul LeWitt on a wall for the first time?
Well, for example, I remember in the exhibition at Mass MoCA, there's one particular room which is covered with this beautiful, beautiful, pale, warm blue. And all over it are chalk marks, or at least white. I think it is chalk, but anyway, white marks. And there are a series of curves and lines, each one of them dictated by kind of an equation. And the way that they're distributed follows, if you will, a logic that he set in motion. But the results are as beautiful as anything that you would find in an Islamic mosque or the Alhambra, as beautiful as anything you would find in modern architecture, as beautiful, in fact, as frescoes that you would find in Italy. And, of course, frescoes were very important to him since he lived in Italy and he looked a lot at the traditions of wall painting in European art. So, you know, the pleasure we find at looking at Piero Francesca, for example, is not just in the beauty of his rendering of the bodies of the people who populate his scenes. It's in the proportions. It's in the shapes and the way they fit together. And in a sense, what LeWitt was doing was the shapes and the way they fit together.
Back in 1967, he told Art Forum magazine, "Conceptual art is not necessarily logical. The ideas need not be complex. Most ideas that are successful are ludicrously simple. Successful ideas generally have the appearance of simplicity because they seem inevitable." It seems as though somehow or other, Robert Storr, between the mathematical concepts he was using to get at some of this work and then the very simple shapes that we see on the walls, he was able to bridge these two worlds of the very, very simple and the very complex in a way that maybe a lot of artists have not been able to do.
Well, I quite agree, and I think one of the principal problems is the people who do the explaining often go from very complex to positively obscure. And in fact, what you want to do is go the other direction. But for example, I'm a complete Luddite when it comes to mathematics. My daughter is a mathematician. So I ask her to explain to me how certain shapes operate in space. And it's possible to do. And I think if you look at Lewitt's art, you can see that he goes step by step towards an elaboration of ideas which create great beauty, great intricacy, but the basic premises are always legible in the drawings. You know that you're dealing with this curve, that line, this interval, this vector, sort of spread of an angle and so on. And then you see how he articulates it over a wide area of space. It's much like listening to music. It's much like listening to any kind of very structured sound. And it's beautiful because of the care with which he puts it together, the balance and proportion of what he does.
As we've said before, Mass MoCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Massachusetts up in North Adams, has this amazing retrospective. It was a collaboration between the Yale University Art Gallery and Mass MoCA and the Williams College Museum of Art. It is indeed three floors of this massive building, all dedicated to the wall drawings, the paintings of Saul LeWitt. You can see, Robert Storr, as you walk through these floors, the evolution of his art. And maybe you can take us through that evolution from very, very simple and very monochromatic to some of the most brightly colored works of art you can possibly imagine. Vivid, almost hard to look at, so vivid.
Well, first of all, I think we have to say that the collaboration between John Thompson, who directs Mass MoCA, Jock Reynolds, who worked on the show, and Saul, for Yale, and Saul, is a case of how institutions, rather than being competitive, can do something that is greater than any one of them could have done by themselves. And the involvement of the artist was key to this, I think. What you have here, basically, is not a complete version of all of his drawings. There are too many. But you do have this history. And in the first wall drawing he ever made, he made, if I'm not mistaken, in Paula Cooper's gallery. And it's a very simple pencil drawing of a very simple geometric shape on her gallery wall, basically. And it's a good indication of how, from a simple idea, great complexity develops. Because after you've gone through these 100 drawings, some are done with color. Sometimes the color is done with ink. Sometimes it's paint. Sometimes the paint is shiny. Sometimes the paint is matte. Other times it's just pencils, but sometimes the pencils are colored, sometimes they're not, or other applicators, if you will. You realize that when people talk about ideas in art, they tend to reduce things to a simple common denominator. What the artist does is the opposite. They start with a simple common denominator, and they allow things to grow from that, and I mean really grow organically almost.
Now, Regine Basha still is with us on the phone. She's curator of An Exchange with Saul LeWitt. It's an exhibit that's going on at Mass MoCA and at the headquarters of Cabinet Magazine in Brooklyn. Regine, how is the exhibit that you are putting on now interfacing with this ongoing retrospective that's up at Mass MoCA?
Well, there are a number of works that are referencing the instructional mode that, you know, generate the drawings, the wall drawings. And the one work that we're actually featuring at the opening of the show is by Max Goldfarb. And he actually worked as a de-installer, or installer and a de-installer, someone who puts up and takes down exhibitions at Marion Goodman Gallery in 1999. And he was faced with the task of having to scrape off a Saul LeWitt mural. And, you know, being an artist himself, he actually saved it. He saved the mural into little vials and little bottles. And he gave it to his then fiance, or, you know, girlfriend, I believe. And so he's had this now for some time. And so he was one of the artists who came forward and said, you know, I don't know, very sort of sheepishly, I don't know if this is okay, but I sort of have this. We thought it was a really interesting version of the mural in the negative as a point of departure to enter the exhibition.
I just want to say quickly to our audience, An Exchange with Saul LeWitt is a two-part exhibition presented by Cabinet Magazine and Mass MoCA. It's going to be taking place from the end of January through March. There's more information coming up on our website, WNPR.org, keyword where. Regine Basha is curator of An Exchange. She joined us by phone today. Thank you so much for your time, and I truly appreciate you joining us for this conversation about Saul LeWitt's work.
Thank you.
thank you so much. I hope everyone will have a chance to see the shows and to see the murals, really, at Mass MoCA as well.
And we'll be continuing on with Robert Storr from Yale University School of Art, and we'll be talking with some more friends and colleagues of Sol Witt. We'll be talking more about the assistants who did these wall drawings, these paintings for him, and this this remarkable work from this Hartford artist who made his mark around the world but made his home right here in Connecticut. You can join us 860-275-7266 if you've been touched by the art of Sol Witt. We want to hear from you. 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The Hartford-born artist Sol Witt is known for his large-scale wall drawings and paintings, which are still being recreated by artists to this day. His work is the subject of a massive retrospective at Mass MoCA in North Adams, Massachusetts. It's three enormous gallery floors that show off the scope of his work and the changes that it made. Now the museum is presenting another aspect of his work, an exchange in which artists trade works and objects, a kind of open-source model for the art world. We're using that as a jumping-off point to talk about the work of Sol Witt today. 860-275-7266 if you want to join us. Elaine is calling from Simsbury. Hi, Elaine. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, John. Just so happens my husband and I went to see the exhibit yesterday.
Oh, did you? So what did you think?
Ah, spectacular. I really encourage anyone interested to go up and see it. The colors were just amazing, and the shapes and the sheer massiveness of the whole thing. I think Mass MoCA must be the only place where he can really exhibit to this extent, given the size of his work.
Well, I'm really glad you were able to see it, and I'm glad you had such a positive experience. And I, from personal experience, I'll say you can probably go back a couple times, Elaine.
Yes, I'm sure.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, and thanks for joining us here on Where We Live. So, Robert Storr, that's a lot of the type of reaction that I've got from people who have gone to Mass MoCA to see this, that even if they don't know his work, they're overwhelmed by the size and the scope. And again, as we were talking about the changes and the color, how that work changed into such vibrant, colorful work over time.
Well, I think the experience of moving to Italy in the 1970s probably made a big difference. In fact, I'm certain of it, because once he spent considerable time there, he was within easy reach of some of the greatest wall paintings in the history of the world. I mean, there are wall paintings in every part of the world, but what you'll find from the Italian Renaissance and even before the Renaissance is really a spectacular sort of lesson in what is possible. And Sol's genius, and I use the word advisedly, was to figure out a way to do that directly in his own idiom rather than trying to imitate Renaissance art, which has so often been the case. He used something of our time, but he understood what scale, what expanse, what all of the major factors in painting on walls can mean. And going to North Adams is, on one level, like walking into this gigantic book where rather than turn pages, you go around the end of a wall and find another one. But, of course, it's not a book, and books can never do what real works of art can do, particularly large format ones. And in looking at this work, you have to think about what it's like to stand at one end and stand at the other end, to stand in a room surrounded by a single piece like the blue one I described, to walk along a wall as opposed to stand back from it. I mean, every vantage point, every encounter, every way of discovering the images there becomes a fresh experience, and that's what's so exciting about it. That cannot be reproduced.
Robert Storr is the dean of the Yale University School of Art. Stand by for a moment as I bring some other voices into the conversation. Peter Good is a graphic designer and illustrator based in Chester, Connecticut, with his wife, Jan Cummings. He's a principal in Cummings & Good, a graphic design studio based in Chester. He was a close friend of Sol Witt's, and he made the harrowing drive up here through the snow and the ice to be with us in studio today. Peter Good, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So another part of the Sol Witt story that we have yet to get to is the personal side. The fact is that he was a man who was born here in Hartford and lived and worked here in Connecticut. What was he like as a person?
Oh, first of all, it was such an honor to get to know him. And when he moved to Chester in 1986, we became friends. And it was instant mutual respect. We really loved to talk about art. He was a extraordinary person in that he was unlike almost any famous artist that you would think of, and that he was very unpretentious. He was very modest. He disliked talking about himself very much. I would have to extract information about what he was working on at the time. He just didn't like that. Nor did he like art criticism, by the way.
I can only imagine that he didn't like art criticism. A lot of artists don't. Well, one of the things about his personality that seems to come through in the art is this idea of collaboration and exchange, wanting to exchange ideas with other people. Maybe you can talk about that in action, Peter Good, how you saw him exchange ideas with other people.
Well, he first of all, he liked art. He liked a wide range of art. He liked art different from his art, and he has a legacy of changing of exchanging art. And it wasn't just for with other professional artists. He had a lot of student work. He would he traveled the world extensively, and he would visit a wide range of artists, including students and professionals. And if he saw a student work, he would trade one of his professional prints or artworks for the student work.
And we heard about that when we were talking with Regine Basha in the exchange. She was fascinated by this idea. Didn't know many famous artists who ever did that, who would give away their own art just in exchange. This I called it in the opening a kind of an open source idea that we can all just learn from each other and actually trade pieces of art back and forth. It's unique in the art world, it seems.
It must be. I'm sure it is. His house was filled with all kinds of fascinating works. I think the one common denominator of that work, though, there was a thread of continuity, and that was it's work that seemed authentic in some way. Again, unstylized, untrendy, in a way. There was a kind of a purity about that work.
Peter Good is a graphic designer, and he was a close friend of Solowitz. He joins us in studio, as does Jesse Good, a participating artist in An Exchange, the exhibit that we're talking about. He worked with Solowitz on a number of his wall drawings during his life, and he's also from Chester. Jesse Good, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
So maybe you can talk firsthand about working with Solowitz on some of these wall drawings. What was it like?
It was an honor. I worked for I did a number of wall drawings for him. Worked under some of his original craftsmen, and then later on did a bunch of my own. Headed the projects myself for him, and I just felt a great honor to be helping him realize his artwork.
Well, and many people I think who don't understand exactly what Solowitz was trying to get at will say, oh, look, so he gave some ideas, and then a bunch of other talented young artists would come in and paint the wall. And an awful lot of people, especially when there was public art involved, where some public money was being spent, and they'd scratch their heads and go, oh, hold it. The guy just basically gave some instructions, and some other people put the paint on the wall. Is that really his art?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the best analogy is the orchestra analogy, where he's the composer, and we are the instruments, where the look at Mozart, his music's still being made, and no one questions whether it's Mozart or not. So, yeah, these were his works, yeah.
But of course, Peter Good, it is different in the art world. Although the Mozart analogy works in music and everyone's always understood that, did Saul ever face during his lifetime questions from other artists or questions from art critics about whether or not this was indeed legitimate?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he invented a new method of creating art, and as soon as you upset the status quo, you're going to get criticism. And I've argued on his behalf to other cultured people who just could not make the distinction between something done with using your own skill and talent versus something that is executed by your plans. But the other analogy would be an architect who draws up exquisite plans for a building, but the architect isn't expected to build the building.
Well, maybe better than anyone, Jeremy Zimon might be able to explain what some of these architectural drawings were like. He worked on a Lewitt installation since 1989. He was principal assistant on many large-scale sculpture projects. Welcome to the program. First of all, thanks for coming up.
Thanks for having me.
So describe what the instructions were like. What was Solowitz leaving you to do, or was he like a conductor who is in mixing it up, telling you what to do all the time, like a football coach? What was the relationship like?
Saul allowed me to have a pretty broad level of autonomy. I think the type of instruction I would get would be very often a fax to my shop and then some simple statement, can you do this? Or can I come by next month and look at this? And to me, it seemed to make sense. Like, I would interpret what he delivered, which, like Peter described, as an architectural plan often. And so you'd have a top view of something that could be constructed out of a material. And in most instances, I was building what was called a maquette, which is a working model. And for him, I think I bridged this gap often between his conceptual to paper, then to seeing something become three-dimensional more quickly than the large-scale works could be produced. So he may come by a month later and look at the work and say, oh, yeah, that's what I was thinking. Maybe send that off to this particular museum, and they're going to consider it for a project. But the space that I had to work in was an allowance to produce the work in a way that I felt was appropriate construction-wise. And that freedom to work in my own studio, building artwork as opposed to building, I don't know, some cabinetry for an architect, but also just being part of a bigger picture.
Did you want to add something, Peter?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to say that sometimes Saul didn't have a complete idea of what the plan would ultimately be. And I recall once my other son, Justin, was doing some maquettes for Saul for his iceberg sculptures. And those were it was a flat square with intersecting lines, and each intersecting line had a number, which related to a height. And at one point, it required sophisticated math to create these maquettes. And at one point, I asked Saul, I said, well, Saul, I mean, do you have an idea what this is going to be like? Because it was very esoteric. And he says, oh, absolutely not. He said, if I'm surprised, the viewer will be surprised. So this was another way that Saul thought, you know.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Saul LeWitt in his own words, talking about this idea of collaboration and working with some of the assistants who helped him to create his art.
At first, I was doing them all myself. But when they got larger and time became shorter, it was necessary to have help. And eventually, the help got to do them much better than I. And also, once you accept the idea of scale and the idea of size, that many of these things were done for shows with a limited time, it was inevitable that it would have to have a lot of help.
Jeremy Zimon, it almost seems in that there was some sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that the work got too big to do by himself. And then as he brought more people into it, the work got too big to do with just a few people. And then it seemed as though he was able to build on this idea so that he was able to take himself out of the day-to-day creating of the art. Maybe this was his plan all along.
I sort of in the mix of it, I don't think I saw the bigger picture. And yeah. I remember we went to his alma mater, Syracuse University, and he donated a large structure piece that was called Curved Walls. And he showed me the plan on the way up there and said, this is what I'm thinking we want to do, and or I want to do. And we get there, and there are about 15 people to meet us on this hillside, the president of the university and hydro engineers and construction agents. And he said, we want it to kind of curve along here like this along the hillside, and then Jeremy will tell you the rest. And on the way back, he said, you're going to have a degree in block. This is great. And I guess his initial thought with these works was that anyone could do it, and it is interesting to hear in his own words how he thought others could do it better. And I think that's what became true of the wall drawings as well. There were lead assistants, and as someone like Jesse became more proficient in a certain style, he was the go-to guy for a particular drawing, and I would be the go-to person primarily for these larger structure works.
And Jesse, good. He talked in these terms that I think many of us probably wouldn't exactly understand what he was talking about. Did you always get what he was saying?
I think he kept it pretty straight ahead for the wall drawings that I was working on. That reminded me of a story. All the wall drawings I worked on were pretty straight ahead. You could do them all by the plan. There was one case where we were working on one and the wall was falling apart and we had a deadline and we were having a lot of trouble. I think Jeremy was with me at this one, and we went to talk to Saul, and we said, "Saul, this is what's going on," and he said, and this one we were using tape. Most of them we used tape for the acrylics, and we said, "Saul, it's falling apart." We take the tape off. He said, "Well, can't you just, you know, do it by hand?" And I said, "Saul, no, we can't." And afterwards, I was really surprised that I was telling him how to do his artwork. But we had that's how they were done, and that's how they were expected to be done. So that was the machine that he was talking about that was making the art.
We heard in the first segment we were talking about this exhibit in exchange, what many artists were giving to this exhibit. There was one conversation about somebody who had actually scraped the paint off as he was disassembling something and saved the paint in little vials, thinking that this was part of the art and he was going to contribute this back. Peter Good, this idea of destroying something that is a piece of art is another reason why many people look at Saul LeWitt and go, "Hold it, this completely blows my mind. This is a beautiful thing that people have spent quite some time working on, and now we're just going to take it down." Explain that process, because it must have been difficult for him or for people who love his work to see something painted over after a few years.
Oh, yeah, that was true. I remember going to the Great Whitney retrospective, and people were just so ecstatic about it, because a lot of his work is really very highly optical. So you walk into a room and it affects your senses in a very, very powerful, dramatic way. And then 2 months later, it's a white wall. But it's a birth and death. The idea that art is temporal is a part of his work. I mean, it's the creation, the experience of it, and the temporal quality is just something that you kind of accept. It's true. Even wall drawings can be moved as well. In other words, they're painted out and they're transformed. So it's part of the methodology. You
know? If anybody's ever watched a Tibetan mandala being made, it's very similar. It's this very painstaking process over time. The only difference, Jesse Good, is that, unless I'm wrong about this, at the end of the mandala, when it is destroyed ceremonially and it's taken to a body of water and there is a prayer, was there that sort of reverence when the white paint went over the wall drawing and it was just gone, wiped from the earth?
Not that I know of. No ceremony whatsoever. I can remember speaking with the painters who helped prep a wall one time and letting them know that they'll be the ones to cover it over.
We're talking with Jesse Good, who is a participating artist in An Exchange. This is the exhibit that we're using as a jumping-off point to talk about the work of Hartford-born Saul LeWitt. He worked on wall drawings for Saul LeWitt. His father, Peter Good, is a famous graphic designer who's a good friend of Saul LeWitt's. He joins us in studio as well. We're also joined on the phone by Robert Storr. Robert Storr is the dean of the Yale University School of Art, in studio with us as well as Jeremy Zimon. He worked on a number of LeWitt installations as principal assistant on sculpture projects. We'd like you to join the conversation. If you've recently experienced Saul LeWitt's work at Mass MoCA or perhaps Dia Beacon or the Wadsworth Athenaeum, we'd love to hear from you. 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Please join us for our very first WNPR Small Business Breakfast. It's at the Palace Theater in Waterbury on January 26th. So breakfast starts at 7:30, followed by a live broadcast of Where We Live. We'll be talking about how we actually define small business in Connecticut. The event is free and it's open to all. Seating is limited, though, and registration is required. So go to WNPR.org, keyword small biz. You'll get a chance to meet the Where We Live team. We'll be talking about small business in Waterbury and around the state. Our business reporter, Harriet Jones, will be there. It's WNPR's Small Business Breakfast. It's sponsored by our founding partner, Webster Bank. So hopefully you can join us on January 26th. Again, find out more at WNPR.org, keyword small biz. Today in the program, we're talking about the art and the legacy of Saul LeWitt. He's a Hartford-born artist who died just a few years ago, but left this amazing legacy of art, conceptual art, big art, that was on the walls of many institutions that we know very well here in the Wadsworth Athenaeum at Dia Beacon down along the Hudson River, and of course, an amazing retrospective at Mass MoCA. We'll have more information on our website, WNPR.org, keyword where. Before I let him go, I just want to bring in Robert Storr, the dean of the Yale University School of Art. Robert Sturr, you worked on a film about Saul LeWitt's life and wall drawings, and maybe you can just briefly tell us about that, because it's going to be coming up at the Wadsworth Athenaeum on March 17th.
Yes, well, I was just a talking head, I have to say, although I gave some advice in the background. But the film was instigated in part because before his death, Saul agreed, very generously, I should add, to donate a major mural to the new United Nations, United States United Nations Embassy building in Manhattan. It's the only American embassy on our own soil. And he had already donated a mural to the American Embassy in Berlin. And as I say, before his death, he okayed the creation of a new mural, which turned out, in fact, to be, sadly, also Charlie Rothney's last building. Mm. And the film is sort of an outgrowth of that, since we wanted to document the process of that mural's being made. So in a way, it's a testament both to Saul and to Charlie. And it was a beautiful sort of convergence of talents and temperaments in the making of the building. If I can say parenthetically something.
Please.
Historically, actually, much of the art that we look at has been made by many hands. The old studio system of the Renaissance and on down through till very, actually, into the modern era always employed people to make the work that was conceived by others. So, for example, Rubens would do small sketches, and then he would have his assistants knock out the big paintings, and then he'd go back in and retouch areas of it. Now, he chose some pretty spectacular assistants, like Franz Schneider, one of the great still life painters, and Anthony van Dyck, one of the great portrait painters of his era, and many more things. So that this idea of the value of a work in art being invested by the touch of the artist everywhere on its surface is a very narrow definition of what art really is. After all, Pollock worked for Cicados, so did Philip Guston, in order to make murals that were entirely Cicados' sensibility. Mm. LeWitt added something very dramatic to this proposition, but he's not the first person to delegate. And I think the really important thing in his case is that the works are, impermanent. This exhibition in Massachusetts will last for 23 years, which is a long time, but it won't last forever. And as someone who's worked in museums, the business of taking up or putting up and taking down a work by LeWitt does mean that you have to part company with it, and that's sad. On the other hand, when it goes back up again, it has a freshness that a painting which had remained in place or simply aged in storage would not have. So if you think of LeWitt's work really truly being like music, as one of the other speakers said, then each performance gives it not only a new inflection but also this element of sort of suddenly being born all over again.
And as I started the program with the Saul LeWitt wall drawing that I grew up with at the Carnegie Museum of Art in Pittsburgh, just recently got a fresh coat of paint a couple of years ago, and it brightened things up again. Robert Sturr is Dean of the Yale University School of Art. Thank you so much for joining us for a few minutes here on the program. I appreciate your time.
Sure.
I want to get to Liz, who's calling from Glastonbury. Hi, Liz. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I just wanted to say, Saul LeWitt, he's such a touchstone in so many ways. And years ago, I helped Andrea Miller Keller when his work was going up at the Athenaeum host a party for the artist, Joe Watanabe and Anthony, and there was a third artist, I can't remember, painting that. And I saw firsthand how hard they work. And years later, well, this past summer, I graduated from the Connecticut Film Industry Training Program, and I met someone in the program whose mother years ago in New York City took a printmaking course from Saul, but he really didn't know a lot about printmaking and was teaching to sort of pay his way.
Yeah.
And so she knew more about printmaking and helped him teach the course, and he gave her one of his drawings of a line drawing of a man jumping, and it was called Jumping. And it just goes to the idea of the ripple effect of his art, and not only is he a touchstone for the Hartford area and Connecticut, but I mean, gosh, it's like riding right into the realm of intellectual property, where the idea becomes
And Liz, I want to thank you so much for that, because I want to bring up this idea of the ripple effect. And Jeremy Zeman, well, what was the ripple effect that he's had on your life and your art moving forward?
Well, I think the kind of artwork that I started initially produced was more born out of the studio, and Saul had the ability to, in one day, create enough work to keep me busy for 2 years. So it also made me look a little more inward on my own work and look at other ways that I could produce work that had a more immediate sense to it and a more ephemeral. And it sort of brought me back to doing a little more drawing and things that were less arduous.
How did he touch your work, Peter Good?
Well, I always thought that Saul had did have a strong design sense, and I used to assist him with his typography. I always used to say that he's the only designer that has his own brand, which he used to refer to as his coat of arms, which is a square divided into four segments and lines going in four different directions. And he's used that motif over and over and over again. I really connected with him in terms of his choice of typefaces, which was actually very similar to his whole approach to art in general. It was very straightforward, unpretentious. He used to like these bold sans serif fonts, but he always made the decision on the fonts, though, because when I suggested a certain typeface, he would consider it, but then he would say, "Let's use Futura bold condensed or whatever."
Yeah, and this was someone who had his own big ideas. It wasn't just letting anyone else make the decisions for him. This was his collaboration,
He
had strong opinions.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you think of the whole hedgehog and fox dichotomy, he was definitely a hedgehog.
I want to get quickly to Stephen Lloyd. He's an architect who worked with Saul LeWitt to design a synagogue in Chester. Stephen Lloyd, welcome to the program. We just have a couple minutes left, but maybe you can explain how he touched that community of Chester, Connecticut, this small arts community that he was a part of.
Well, it's interesting that he was able, with my assistance and that of many others, to create a permanent structure. You know, unlike a lot of his pieces that were temporary on walls, this building will be in Chester for a long time. And it was really the power of his ideas that made this happen.
Maybe you can explain exactly how he helped you with the building. Again, very quickly, we're just low on time.
Well, he had the idea that it would be good to have it inspired by 19th century wooden structures that are now lost, synagogues from Eastern Europe. And so the idea was an octagon with an east-facing courtyard. And we were able to create that. He came in with some wonderful drawings early on that he drafted himself of the elevation of the chapel and the main sanctuary. And then he also had a very, when we were working together one day, he did a kind of almost a tipped volcano that meant to show that he wanted the geometry of the main space to be skewed so that the skylight would bring light down over the bima.
Well, Stephen Lloyd, because we're low on time, I have to let you go. He's an architect who worked with Saul to design a synagogue in Chester, again, a permanent structure that you can find. But there's so many other places. And before I let you all go, I'll just ask Peter Good, are there some favorite things of Saul LeWitt's that you can see in the world now, whether it's a Mass MoCA or a Dia or at the Wadsworth, something that you might point people to say, yeah, that's his work?
Oh, there's so many. It's hard to single out any. I think Mass MoCA shows the extraordinary range, but any major museum, New Britain Museum of American Art, Wadsworth Athenaeum, they all have, and they're all the variety is so extraordinary, from bright intense colors to very very subtle gloss black on gloss matte.
I'll say they're extraordinary works, and you can go time and time again to Mass MoCA up in North Adams, Massachusetts. Peter Good, of course, a graphic designer, a good friend of Saul LeWitt's. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Jesse Good, who joined us as well, and Jeremy Zeman, who is an assistant for Saul LeWitt. You'll have more on our website, WNPR.org, keyword where. Thanks for joining us. I'm John Dankosky.